The Skiffy and Fanny Show is listener-supported, which means basically you guys listen and we feel really good about ourselves. But if you'd also like to help us a little bit, you can go to audibletrial.com/skiffyandfanty, sign up for a 1-month free trial membership, get a free book, which is pretty cool, and the bonus is that it helps us a little bit. So go ahead and check that out at audibletrial.com/skiffyandfanty and enjoy the episode.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
But to Krell forgot one thing, it's monsters talk. Monsters from the id.
There you go again, always blaming me for everything.
Go switch off!
It's a trap!
This looks extraordinarily bad.
Commencing countdown. T minus 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to the Skiffy and Fanty Show, a Shoot the Wiz subcast. I'm Sean.
I'm Mike.
And I'm Paul.
And this is the first of our, I guess we're just going to call them our rewatch sessions. Although for me, this is going to be the first time I've ever actually watched more than one episode of Babylon 5. So that's obviously what we're talking about. Talking about Babylon 5 today. We're doing this disc by disc. So the first disc contains 4 episodes. Obviously the first 4, it's not like out of order. So the episodes we're dealing with today are Midnight, On the Firing Line, Soul Hunter, Born to the Purple, and Infection. These all released in January and February of 1994. It's a long-ass time ago.
It was an eternity ago.
I know. All right, so Paul and Mike, you two have been Babylon 5 fans to some degree. So you've seen all of this show already at some point, and in some cases have rewatched it. So I actually want you to explain why you personally think this is a good show. So we'll start with you, Mike.
Okay, so for me, I watched Deep Space Nine while a lot of my friends and people who would later be friends watched Babylon 5. So I came to it later in life. And I watched it in college, and it then became probably my number one favorite long-form televisual science fiction. I think that it is unsurpassed of stuff I've seen, and I haven't seen everything, in terms of storytelling that accretes meaning, that over time and with greater exposure and the longer running of the show, everything, almost everything about it gets better, that these episodes in season one get better the more of the rest of the show that you've seen, because Straczynski's model is very much a mosaic, where once you get to see the whole picture, the beauty intensifies. And I think that it's really remarkable in that way and in some other elements. I'll let Paul tackle some other bit.
Well, Paul, give me your personal reason.
I watched Babylon 5 along with Deep Space Nine back in the day on television. I immersed myself in both of them. I thought it was odd that we had two science fiction TV shows taking place on a space station, but I went with it. And Babylon 5, along with Deep Space Nine, would later turn out to be very seminal in terms of science fiction television ever since. And I do think that the longer it goes on, I mean, aside from say things like the special effects, the storytelling and what the show was trying to do are more and more resonant the further I get away from it.
Fair enough. All right. Well, why don't we dive in? Well, I'm not sure how to start because we've never done TV shows before, and you guys have the benefit of foreknowledge. You've seen the rest of this, so you know how these piece together in terms of the larger narrative. I don't yet, because the only episode I'd seen before this was the TV movie where what the hell is his name? Not Jacquard, Londo. Londo is basically telling this story of the war. I'm not sure what that's from, if that's after the series, it's one of the TV movies, or if it's like a pilot or something. That's the only thing I'd seen before I'd watched these 4 episodes, except I've seen the first episode twice now, because I tried to watch this show a long time ago and didn't get into it. So why don't we just start then by going over the things you guys like, since this is the show that you all love. We'll start with likes just to be nice to it, unless somebody,
Did we want to tackle this episode by episode or the four episodes as a group?
I figured we'd just go with it as a group. Okay. But if you feel that that doesn't work, we can switch the format and go episode by episode and try to quick shot them. Because I don't want to be here for like an hour and a half. So why don't we start with you, Mike? So something that you find particularly good about these early episodes.
Well, I think the biggest plus that can be leveled at most of season one is the incredible, almost unprecedented amount of groundwork that they lay. Babylon 5 is gigantically an ensemble show. It was always designed as a 5-season giant arc serial more than episodic show, even though there are episodic bits. And we have two of them in this disc, where you introduce crew, you introduce the ambassadors, you introduce all the different alien races. And even while that big scale groundwork is being done, it gets to conflict right away by positioning the Narn versus the Centauri and giving us representatives of these two races that stand out very intensely as characters from the beginning. So I think that those are some notes in its credit from the beginning.
Excellent. Okay, Paul, why don't you jump in?
From a more technical standpoint, the music. I mean, the music of this series still stands out as really good audio. It's a really good soundtrack that later on shows like, say, Battlestar Galactica would be known for its music. But this show really really laid the groundwork for that. In addition to setting up all these characters, setting up a very complex universe. Babylon 5 was starting a whole new universe from scratch, and it had a lot of ground laying to do, and it does it in these four episodes. I mean, we don't meet every main character in episode one. It takes the four episodes to get to meet all the ambassadors, all the major Earth people, and their subordinates. So it's very patient in building it up that way.
Okay, I guess I could tack on that something that I did appreciate about these first four episodes is I appreciate the larger narrative that it clearly wants to tell. Obviously, we're only four episodes in, so that narrative is like we're getting bits and pieces at this point. But I do like the idea that this isn't just, like a war narrative. It's actually sort of set in the eddy between wars. So there's this big war that has happened. I'm sorry, I'm going to butcher the entire history that precedes because I'm not a Babylon 5 nut yet. So I don't know the full history, but there's a war and the bad stuff happens and that war's ended. And so Babylon 5 is one of the few remaining places where all of the alien races collect and a lot of ambassadorial duty and the negotiations take place. And I appreciate that is the effort that's being done to show we now have this war stuff is over. Now how do we put together the pieces afterwards and actually get people to, kind of like each other at least enough not to want to exterminate one another, which proves particularly difficult because I think the very first episode, Midnight on the Firing Line, Jakar and Londo, the respective ambassadors of their races, I'm sorry, I can't remember the races they are, funny hair guy and cool alien face dude. And their initial conflict is that the fact that both of their governments are trying to backstab one another at every opportunity they can get because these are former warring species. And I appreciate that's the kind of narrative that's going on underneath. And seeing the politics being played out, which doesn't get done, it at least hadn't, in my knowledge, been done very often in science fiction television. Even something like Star Trek, The Next Generation, occasionally dealt with the politics of Starfleet, but it was mostly just, we're going off into space and we're dealing with, alien species and their politics, but we're not really dealing with, what is it like to be in the war room, while the encroaching Borg fleet is coming. Like, what is that like? We don't really get that perspective very often. So that's what I like about at least the setup. If that makes any sense.
That makes perfect sense. It's a frame we didn't and don't get to see much in science fiction. It's usually more action adventure rather than politics and social and alien conflict. And that's what Babylon 5 provides in spades.
All right. Fair enough. Yeah. Michael?
Yeah, I think it's really exciting for me to go back to Babylon 5 and to see it as that hybrid diplomatic military storyline. And kind of looking at it on the long view, it's a science fiction that also has some elements in common with epic fantasy. And I imagine we'll be able to talk about that more as the show goes on. But just it sets incredible stakes, and it gives credence and kind of narrative weight to diplomacy as a good option, not as the option of weak people who aren't strong enough to solve the situation.
Hmm. Yeah. Well, this seems like actually, based on the fact that we're dealing with a larger narrative, maybe it would be prudent to actually address the individual episodes. It seems like that just would make more sense to actually kind of talk in more specifics about each episode. So why don't we just start with number one, and we can kind of maybe lob more general criticisms later. But the first episode is Midnight on the Firing Line. This is the sort of setup episode. And the basic premise is there's a Narn attack on a Centauri. Sorry, okay, now I know who they are. Funny hair people are Centauris. The Narn are the cool alien face dudes. So there's been an attack on one of the colonies, the Centauri colonies. This is particularly emotional for Londo because it happened. So just so happens that one of his relatives, I think it's his cousin or nephew, it's his nephew, is on that planet. And that's sort of the backdrop. There's also happens to be this other thing that Garibaldi is dealing with, involving raiders who have been attacking ships and basically stealing shit, which, you know, that's what happens in space because all space has to have pirates. I'm pretty sure they're not Somali, though. Anyway, but that's the kind of backdrop. And so I'll just say that for our first episode, I don't think it's good in the larger scheme, only because it tries to do so much in what is essentially like a 40-minute time slot. And I feel like this episode really was too, because I felt the resolution was too quick. It was too like, aha, we caught you, Narn people. You've been doing bad things. And, you know, like waggle the finger, and then that was it. And it felt to me like this is literally an act of war right now. What they've just done, they've attacked and invaded a planet which is currently under control by the Centauri. That's an act of war. That seems to me that the resolution of just kind of getting to the end and just kind of sticking it to him didn't work for me. It was too quick. Thoughts? Or did I just totally ruin everything?
No, you didn't ruin everything.
Sorry.
No.
Okay.
Now, it's funny that first time I had seen this way back in the day, I had not seen what was later called the real pilot episode. I think it's called In the Gathering, Mike. Is that right? Do you remember that one?
I think, is it just called The Gathering?
The Gathering. Thank you. I had not seen that, and this wasn't part of the remit of the series, but I had the events of that in my mind when watching this, which was inescapable, and I thought I could see how that actually ties to this episode really well, as far as especially as the Narn being these aggressive antagonists that are going to take their place on the stage of the galaxy at last after being under oppression by the Centauri for so long. And Sean, I see what you mean, that they were put in their place pretty fast and perhaps a little too patly, but they also were trying to find a way to tie the A and B plot. I mean, you're the A plot of the attack on the Centauri colony, the B plot of the raiders, and I think they tied them a little too neatly. I do see your point. And there's also a lot of, and you'll see this throughout the series, a lot of what Stargate fans will call activating chevrons. There's lots of stock stuff of ships getting loaded up and firing off. There's a lot of footage of that you'll see again and again in this. And this first episode shows that. That kind of annoyed me this time, now that I knew what to look for it.
Sure, yeah. And I guess my only issue is most science fiction is not narrative television. It's anthology based, which is, you know, there may be a larger narrative, but mostly it's, you know, each episode self-contained. We get like little, maybe little pieces of new characterization, but they're also like Sliders is a good example, or even TNG, for the most part, is anthology oriented. And I feel like this comes at that, like, this is that first major science fiction show alongside Deep Space Nine that actually bridges the gap and is not sure whether it wants to be fully narrative yet, at least at these first episodes, or if it wants to be an anthology-based story that just so happens to have a kind of overarching narrative. And I think that's why those resolutions are really they're quick, because they're trying to tell what are anthology stories, self-contained stories in each individual episode, but also have the larger narrative. And I feel like that's something that maybe current television is getting over and is just deciding which one it wants to be.
As we go through these seasons, you'll see that that balance will change.
Okay, so the show actually changes. Okay.
Yes, I think Mike wants to speak to that or something else, I believe.
Yeah, go for it, Mike.
I think that I may be misrepresenting Straczynski, so I apologize. If he wants to correct us, he's welcome to email us at, feedback and Skiffy and Fanti.
It's just,
skiffyandfanti@gmail.com.
Yes, please email us, Mr. Straczynski. I think that he wanted to do a fully serial story and was told to put in episodic bits.
Oh, okay.
As the series goes on, it moves towards fully serial with even less episodic. The note I want to make about episode one is that we see in the Narn and the Centauri an interesting science fictional post-colonial narrative, yeah, where we have the Narn who are like literally doing the Return of the Repressed, where they're seeking vengeance for generations of conflict. And this is one of the things I really like about Babylon 5 and this mode of science fiction, is letting kind of things that have happened in our world and mapping alternate versions of them forward so that we get to re-examine them from a different perspective.
Yeah, and I absolutely agree. And I guess my perspective is I want more of that. And the first four episodes don't necessarily give us much. It's sort of like a teaser. This first episode is a teaser. And I feel like it's the appetizer to a really tasty burger. And I just want to get the burger because the appetizer is not as good. Does that make sense? Like, it's still tasty. Like, chicken tenders are nice, but that really good cheeseburger with like the really expensive Applewood bacon, that's so much better than the stupid chicken tenders.
I think Babylon 5 is a 13 course Roman just feast. So you can't start with a cheeseburger if you're going to do 13 courses.
All right, fair enough. Okay, so I mean, I think overall, like, it's not actually a bad first episode in terms of just the narrative and the structure. I think it's actually decent enough, despite my criticisms. Does everyone kind of agree that it's a decent first episode, or do you have any other thoughts?
I'm glad, as I said before, I'm glad they didn't try to throw in Dr. Franklin and the sub-ambassadors into this episode as well. I'm glad they waited, because they could never have made it work trying to put everybody in that first episode.
Yeah, it would be too much. I mean, there's already two narratives in this one thing, the Raiders and the Narn, although they do connect at the end, because the Raiders are getting their weapons from the Narn, or at least that's the implication. That's what the commander, whose name has now just escaped my brain, but he basically accuses Jakar of, you know, the Narn were known during the war to basically sell to anybody, and well, guess what, they've got Narn weapons. So but I do agree with you, Mike, that the colonial narrative is really interesting, that they're actually playing that out, which based on what I know of the show, and I wouldn't have known this if I'd watched it in 1994, I know that kind of stuff is going to be important later. So, but anyway, does any last comments? You want to jump to Soul Hunter?
Let's jump to Soul Hunter.
All right. So I've talked so much already. So why don't you guys, Mike, we'll start with you. What do you think about this particular episode?
So I think the major important thing that we get out of Soul Hunter for the overall experience in Babylon 5 in terms of the A plot is just that this is a world where mysticism is a real thing, that it's not a mastered universe, that humanity has entered a larger, kind of universe, too many uses, and that there are a lot of things that humanity just doesn't understand. That the Soul Hunter is a mysterious being, and that a lot of the stuff we're going to see scientific explanations for, but there is room for the numinous in this science fiction.
Mm. I just want to tie into that, that we learn things, especially while we get the first intimations of those things that are going to be major series themes. I had not realized at the time when I watched it how, although this episode looks at the first to be standing alone, okay, first contact with an alien, he's gathering soul, whatever, but it, I mean, we get the introduction of Delenn, we get the idea of souls, we get introduction, as Mike said, into the Numis that's going to be play a major part in what happens in the series later.
Yeah, Delenn is Minbari?
Yep.
Okay, and if I recall correctly, in the episode, the soul hunters, they are particularly despised by the Minbari because the Minbari sort of believe that the Soul Hunters like are coming for them, that they're basically the horrors that people tell their children about in the, you know, as their nighttime bed stories, and the creation of nightmares. And actually, when you look at the guy, I can't remember who it is that plays the character of the Soul Hunter, or at least the one Soul Hunter.
M. Morgan Shepherd. And I found that funny because he's the voice of Civilization V. And when I saw him on the show again, I was like, oh my God, it's Civ 5 guy.
Well, he's legitimately creepy in this. I mean, he's reading all of these lines and, you know, if you really listen to what he's saying, he's not actually saying anything terribly horrendous. It's just the way he says them is completely unnerving. And because of the way that the Soul Hunters work. So I really liked him as an individual in this particular episode because he's like one individual. He's like one little character throwaway and maybe never shows up again ever. Does he?
We see one other Soul Hunter in the entire series. Is that right, Mike? Or is that then one of the movies?
I think it's one of the movies. I'm checking the Wikipedia page here. It looks like it shows up.
Oh, no, he does show up later.
Oh, War Without End in season 3.
Yeah,
but he's not a Soul Hunter again. So
yeah,
but that's fun. Yeah, so I guess I really appreciated the acting of the individual, and the story in and of itself I think was pretty good. I guess my only criticism up to this point is I think this is the episode. It's either this one or the one after when we learn about Ivanova. I think it's this one or the next one we learn about her father who apologizes to her, and it's actually probably the next one, so I'll just whatever. I guess my problem with her character is she's played off somewhat as a stereotype, like Russian women are strong and hard-nosed and all these kinds of things. And so when they throw this father thing in, that she has these father issues and her father apologizes to her in this kind of big moment, that was another one of those moments where it's like, this is such a defining character moment that if you throw it away in like a 30-second bit and then never mention it in the episode that follows, that can't work. Her character is defined, clearly is defined by this moment, so we need more. We need to see more of who she is. And I don't feel like we ever get a sense of who she is. She's just stern, hard-nosed, you know, of blah, blah, blah.
I think this is another case where the long-form nature of the show is both a benefit and a drawback. Ivanova's Russianness and her relationship to her family is a central theme for the character over years of storytelling.
It is a long game, Sean. It's kind of unfair to see it now because it was a tiny bit, but it's like the mosaic of the series. We build up more and more about what she is and what she is, and we will learn more about her family, as Mike said, and how she fits into that and House made her who she is.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I understand it. I understand this idea that it becomes a mosaic over time and that these things will have more value later. I guess for me, I want my narrative to give me some of that value now because I need to feel like I care about her, but I don't. Like, she's the one character in the whole show right now that I don't care about, who is a repeat character who keeps showing up, at least in these episodes. And it's largely because there is almost nothing about her. I mean, when we go to Garibaldi's character, we've gotten all little tidbits of characterization about him, his relationship with the commander, his sort of behavior around women, all these kinds of little quirks. We understand somewhat of who he is as a character. We understand the commander because we get little bits and pieces of who he is in each episode. Her, when we get the pieces, they're these like huge emotional moments, and then it's like, and then we're going to forget that ever happened. And that I need some of the value. I need to know who she is so that when that happens, I feel for her as a character more than just because it's a sad moment. I need to feel like this is important beyond the fact that, you know, it's her father. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that's a legit concern. I think it's important to value the kind of first time through experience because, you know, Paul and I have seen everything. So we can read more and we can read the later work into an episode. And it's unfair to just infinitely defer judgment. And I think Ivanova is a tricky character from the beginning because she's the straight man to both Sinclair and to Garibaldi. And characterization of someone who is stern is difficult because so many of their reactions are to be the stable, to be the flat surface off of which other characters bounce, and that makes it harder for that character to kind of be spiky or stand out and be emergent and have that emotional effect on somebody.
I guess
that's fair.
Yeah, I mean, it's a fair point. I guess you could get around some of that by actually showing her in her private spaces for brief moments. So that, like, you know, when she, like, little things you could do where you show that she struggles with this persona she's presenting, even if only just by little glimpses of her struggle, without her ever having to reveal it to the other characters, so that we go, I wonder why she's having such a hard time maintaining this. And as these things, I don't know, this is me criticizing something that's already been made, so it's kind of unfair, but yeah, I don't know.
So we move to episode 3 then?
Yep, Born to the Purple, which involves beautiful slaves, as the description says. And again, this goes back to the political, which I really appreciated, in actually political corruption in a sort of weird way, because the main character is essentially acting as a, or excuse me, the female character, the main female character is acting as a spy, and it's sort of Londo's desires that gets the best of him.
Londo is as the key thing to his little safe says wine, women, and song. That's Londo, and this is a very strong Londo episode. We understand Londo, and there'll be another episode coming up, and I think Mike knows which one I'm talking about, where we'll see much more of the lighter side of Londo. This is, even though there's a whole spy thing, this is the lighter side of Londo, and we get to see that the nice side of Londo, and when he's happy, this is, we get to see his bliss, so for a bit moments, and again, there we go with the long game. You'll appreciate this. You'll appreciate this levity later. Trust me.
I like Londo. He's like my favorite character right now.
He's one of my favorites in the entire series.
Him and Jakar. I kind of just want the show to be like the Londo Jakar sitcom.
there are episodes that are a little like that.
Because I feel like that would be a great show. Just like these two ambassadors who secretly like each other. Not like, but, you know, like each other as people. But because they come from different species and different histories, they like have to hate each other. So it's a constant struggle. And then at the end, they actually realize that like they're the best friends that could ever happen. And they start a Babylon 5 basketball team, and they just have a good time.
This is also the episode that gives me my catchphrase for work. Don't give away the home world.
Oh yes, that was a great line.
I still left. That's my catchphrase at work for maintaining warranty claims. Don't give away the home world.
That's a really good line, and I really liked Londo. Is just, I just love the actor. I don't know what the accent is.
Do you know the story, Mike, or shall I tell it?
You go for it.
Apparently, Peter Jurassic decided to invent an accent for the Centauri for the series, so he came up with this unique accent that was not based on anything on Earth. He just mixed things together. When we meet other Centauri, especially the Centauri men, they don't go for this accent. Nobody speaks Centauri or English like Londo does. It's amazing, and the voice does help distinguish him as much as his hair and appearance.
Yeah.
Yeah, his voice is not only his accent, but the way that the character sees the world. And I love how Londo represents the glory lost of a republic that has fallen and may one day rise again. And we see that in the way that Londo has his public face and his private face. And we see the private face with Adira, which really gives us a contrast that we build from throughout the series.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, I find Londo's just such a fascinating character. And it's weird because – not weird that I find him fascinating, but more that there's actually a lot of attention paid to him as a character, despite the fact that he's not actually the main cast member. He's one of the main secondary cast members. But there is a lot of attention paid to who he is as an individual in all of his warts and all. Like, all of that is there. And I really appreciate that, because the second he starts talking, I'm just like, I don't know what the hell you're saying, but I want to keep listening to you. Because that accent is so fascinating, the way he talks, his mannerisms, all of it. I mean, he really put it all into this performance, I feel like. But, you know, what am I?
Have either of you read Diplomatic Act?
No.
It's a science fiction novel that Peter Jurassic, the actor who plays Londo, co-wrote. And I forgot, I'd have to Google it to find out. Basically, the premise is the main character plays a diplomat, much like Londo, on a TV series. And aliens kidnap him, thinking he's a real diplomat, and want him to straighten out their problem, thinking that, well, he's a great diplomat, he can solve everything. Of course, he has absolutely no clue. He's a big fish out of water. And the cover, as I recall, shows a very Alondo-like alien sitting at a bar.
With a blue alien critter. Yeah, the other guy was William H. Keith.
Thank you.
No, I'm not sure who that is, but it came out from Bane, or at least the edition I'm looking at here came out from Bane. Yeah. I'm assuming that's the original.
Yeah,
it says first edition. So that's very interesting. I wonder – well, he wrote it in – it looks like 1988 is when it was published. So obviously he was influenced by Babylon. So
I mean, Londo is a breakout character, and that novel proves it.
Yeah, absolutely. So okay, any other last thoughts on Born to the Purple? We didn't talk about the slave trade.
The fact that there's slavery in this universe, it shows the darker side of this universe. It's not all a bright, shiny future. I mean, we get to see that. We get the intimations of that with all the brown sectors. But yeah, the whole idea that there's a galaxy-wide slave trade kind of shows that this is not a completely bright, shiny future.
Yeah, and it's not just slavery. It's actually sexual slavery, because they're basically moving women as prostitutes is essentially what they're using them for. So, I mean, that's another thing that I did not expect from a 1990s science fiction TV show, you know, to just deal with that so blatantly. I mean, that's something I'd expect in BSG, which comes from a whole decade later and a whole different generation. But yeah, it's something that there are these like little tidbits, and it's like, I don't hate the show. I have issues with it. And some of the issues, I guess I'll probably talk about later. But there are these like glimmers of just brilliance that I want the focus to go to those things. But it seems like, based on what you guys are saying, that'll happen later. I'll get some of that focus. So, do you want to skip to the next episode?
Sure.
Okay. All right. Last episode's Infection. So this is the I guess archaeologist getting into trouble episode. And we've already been introduced at this point to the doctor. I think the doctor comes in the previous episode, and one of his former colleagues shows up with this weird biological technology, and it grafts to somebody and nearly destroys Babylon 5 and turns them into a super weapon. Thoughts, anybody? Who wants to go first?
We've been speaking a lot. Why don't we let Mike take the lead?
Yes, Mike, you're going.
So this is another strongly episodic show from season one. But like a lot of the episodic Babylon 5 bits, it's strongly character driven. So this is our first real episode long time with Dr. Franklin. And we get to see how he's connected with people, how he's really at the top of his field in certain elements. We introduce the fact that there's organic technology. Again, we're adding to the sense of the numinous and the size of the universe. I'm not a huge fan of the A plot itself in terms of like, oh no, there's a thing and it infects a dude and then there's a death soldier. Like that doesn't really do a whole lot for me. But the character that it kind of provokes out of Franklin, and then getting to see Sinclair in almost James Tiberius Kirk level bravery, which is an element with Sinclair that we're going to get more out of. We kind of get a sense of why Sinclair is that rash. So any time that there's an episodic Babylon 5, it really, for me, is all about the character. What character are we spending time with? And then how does that build them up? And then what can we look back on the episode with the hindsight of seeing the whole series and get extra out of, which is one of the reasons why I just adore the show, is that it bears those rereadings and rewatchings.
And I just found out that Richard Biggs, who played Dr. Franklin, died.
Yeah, a couple of the actors who have been in this series have died over the years, unfortunately. Him most recently.
Andreas Katsoulis also passed away a while back.
Who's that?
Jakar.
Oh!
Yeah.
But I like him.
Yeah.
Oh. That totally thanks, guys. Thanks.
I think it's important to be able to go back and look and watch these shows and honor the contributions that these actors who have now passed have made to dramatic science fiction. You know, for a lot of these people, this was their defining role. And we get to keep that and remember it and talk about their work that endures past their lives.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. And clearly Babylon 5, I suspect that in time, it's going to be that show that gets sort of like rediscovered. Because it seems like Babylon 5 has a very small, in comparison to other shows, a small but very dedicated fan base. But that's also true of someone like Philip K. Dick. And based on the kinds of things that you guys have already talked about and what people have already said about Babylon 5, it seems like this is a show that, like, in a decade, people are going to rediscover and realize it was, like, genius. If they don't already realize it.
One can hope.
Well, I hope. Well, I mean, it would be nice because if there's that resurgence, maybe they can finally give Straczynski the budget he needs to actually finish all the stuff he wants to do. So, because he still wants to do stuff set in the universe. There's still narrative to tell, isn't there? So
There's plenty of room for narrative.
Yeah.
There's definitely room, but I don't think the main story needs to be added to. Like, unlike a lot of shows, he got to do the whole thing, which I'm really grateful for.
Mm. Well, that's good. Anyway, so other thoughts about Infection?
Hey, it's David McCollum. I had forgotten he was in this episode. Like, hey, there's a flash in the past. And yeah, this is definitely a very, as Mike said, a very strong Franklin episode. We get to see Dr. Franklin. We lay down the idea of ancient technology and prospecting and looking for that ancient technology, which is going to become very important later on in the series. So even though this is very much a single episode, and the A-plot is, bioweapons going to kill things. It's not so great. It does lay down some tracks for stuff coming on later.
That's a fair point. Yeah, and I didn't really know. I knew I recognized that guy's face, David McCollum. And then I realized it's because he's from NCIS. So,
among other things, although at the time that was before NCIS, I was thinking him from The Man from U.N.C.L.E.
Fair, yeah. I mean, that's where I recognize him from, because my sister watches way too much NCIS, and when I'm there, I have to watch it. So, yeah. So, I mean, I agree with what Mike and Paul, you both have said that the sort of like biotechnology bit is kind of like whatever. Although, I'm really curious what they're going to do with it, because at the end, the military shows up and takes it all, which usually spells trouble when the military shows up to take your shit.
Well, no spoilers.
Unless he's a lazy writer, he's going to address that at some point. It has to. It's kind of a big deal. But
yeah, and it's worth noting here that Straczynski wrote an overwhelming majority of the scripts for the show, which is very uncommon for an SF show of the time. It didn't have so much the regular writer's room. It was there's a more direct relationship, a one-to-one relationship between Straczynski's vision and the words on the page than for a lot of shows, which I think gives it a clarity of focus, but also means that Straczynski's weaknesses are pretty much always present throughout the show.
That's a very good point.
I think that on the page-by-page basis, some of his dialogue is wooden as written, and that is kind of an ongoing problem at times. But his facility with long-form storytelling is, for me, unmatched.
Yeah, and I would agree with you there that it's either the dialogue or the direction that in some cases the acting is not up to par with, and it may just because it's the 90s, and when you watch a lot of 90s TV, that it's very different from the kind of work you see now, where the attention is, the way in which acting is produced. It's sort of like looking at movies today in comparison to like 1950s movie. It's just a very different style of acting. Does that make sense?
Yes, and there's also, there is almost a stilted is really the wrong word, but there's a mannered approach to some of the acting in the show. I don't want to use the word Shakespearean too much, lean on it, but I mean, just there's a lot of over drama, and that sometimes that combined with the direction and the dialogue can lead to problems in the series, and why sometimes the series doesn't get a entirely positive reputation. So people remember that like, oh, that, yeah. You have to look past that. You have to look at the long poem storytelling, as Mike said, and the vision, and in its moments of transcendent grace, it does rise above the dialogue and the acting to be something very, very memorable.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
I think it's at times operatic in both good and bad ways.
That's a word I couldn't remember, Mike. Thanks.
That's actually a great way to describe it, because it is very much almost like a space opera with all of its good and bad trappings. So, yeah, I would absolutely agree with that. Okay, well, we've gone through the four episodes. I guess the only last thing I'm going to say, and it's something I got in trouble for mentioning before, I think on Twitter, is I don't understand why the show relies on using CGI when most of the episodes that I mean, maybe this changes later and it'll just make more sense later, but based on the four episodes I've seen, there's almost no reason for them to have to use this really, what even for 1994 was not great CGI. Because most of the stuff they're showing in CG is just the Babylon 5 just floating in space. And I just don't understand why they couldn't have built just one model and done some quick blue screen shots and just made it look. Because it couldn't have been that much more expensive to do the model. It must have been cheaper because CGI was so new then. And the graphics just, at times the graphics really annoy the hell out of me.
And I was in that Twitter conversation and got a lot of people who'd seen at the time to give their opinions. Paul, you watched at the time. What were your thoughts on the CG versus what else was being done in the genre?
CG was definitely an evolving medium. I think that, well, they had a bigger budget, that Deep Space Nine was doing much better.
Yeah.
But then again, they have much more to work with. Babylon 5 CG was not great then, and it does not aged very well at all. It is wince inducing.
No.
When the show gets farther along, the CG gets a bit better, and I think the complexity of the space fight scenes that it plays out and achieves are sufficiently high that it justifies the use of CG, because I haven't seen model fight choreography for spaceships that's matched what Babylon 5 did of stuff that was done by that time. I don't ever remember Next Gen being that intricate. By the time that Deep Space Nine was getting that intricate, I'm not sure if they were using only models.
I don't know.
I mean, I doubt it. I suspect that Deep Space Nine was using CG or combinations. I mean, that's my guess, although I can't confirm that at this point. But I mean, it is just a noticeable thing. And I guess one thing that I'd said to you, Mike, and I suspect you'll disagree, is for me, when it comes to writing for TV, if you can't do something particularly well, and I understand that later in the show, they actually have to use CG because they're doing very enormous space-related battles and those kinds of things. But I feel like if you can't do it now, save your budget and do it later. Do it for something else or write around it so that you don't have to do this. You can focus on other things. So like an example that I think I brought up was like Game of Thrones. Like I was really pissed in season one that they didn't show one of the fights. I understood why. They didn't have the budget to do they didn't show either battle. They couldn't have shown any of the battle. They didn't have the budget for it. So they wrote around it. I didn't think it worked quite as well, but that's just based on the fact that it's the book. But they ended up using that same, a much larger budget to actually show a fight scene later, so that when you first saw an actual fight scene, these enormous fight scenes, these war battles, it looks really great because they finally got the budget to be able to do it. And that maybe is an unfair comparison because it's HBO and it comes from a much different period of time. But I mean, what are your thoughts on that, Mike?
I think that Babylon 5 CG definitely looks less impressive the farther away from 94 through 98, 99 that we are. And that is definitely something that can stand in people's way when they're watching or coming to the show later on. And that may be one of the barriers to it getting rediscovered in the way that we were hoping that it does and will. I think that the CG in Babylon 5 does some very interesting things. The way that the Star Furies move, I think, works maybe better in CG or more impressively. And I think it was a cool, ambitious bit and approach for the Babylon 5 team to say, nope, we're going to do all CGI from the beginning, and we're going to see how well we can do it, even with the perhaps not as high budget. I think that there are some losses there because there's a lot of reused shots, and later on, it doesn't look as impressive as maybe some of the more practical Deep Space Nine stuff that it was contemporary with. Sure. But I think I'm happy with the overall decision to do all CGI for Babylon 5.
Fair enough. Mm-hmm. I will say, though, in the first episodes, the only one that uses a significant amount of CG is actually the first episode. The other three really don't. It's very
much
little.
More bottled on the station itself. That's why.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I think, honestly, when they're on the station, we begin to get a lot more interesting stuff going, at least in these first episodes. I mean, stuff that you'd already mentioned, Mike. I mean, the sort of the politics and the colonialism that's in that first episode, or some of the stuff that we get with Londo in episode 3. That's one thing I really like about the structure and setting it on this darn ship thing that looks like a giant canister of tear gas from hell. Is the fact that we get so embedded into their lives, even in these four episodes, that when we're starting to learn about certain characters in very deep and meaningful ways. And there are some characters that I want to see lots and lots and lots more of, which is one thing I will say is going really well for Babylon 5, is I actually care about some people, which I can't always say for TV I watch, in which I just – there's some shows where I watch it and I just like really hope people will just die off and they get a whole new cast next episode. But that's not – I don't wish that on this show.
Well, I hope that the succeeding episodes and discs will live up to your expectations, Sean. I see that the next disc will include the introduction of one of my favorite antagonists in all science fiction. And I'll say no more about that.
Shh.
Sorry.
Mike, any last thoughts?
No. Do we want to grade by disc, by episode, or hold off on grading?
I feel like we should hold off on grading until we get through the whole season.
Yeah, I think we should do it by season.
So I feel like it's kind of unfair to grade either individual or just like a disc, because as you say, right, it's traveling the line between episodic and long-form narrative, and it's really hard to make a full assessment of these episodes until we get a somewhat bigger picture.
Yeah, I'd agree.
Okay. All right, well, all right, any last quick thoughts anyone has, or is that it?
I think I'm good.
Yeah, I definitely invite all Skiffy and Fanti viewers to watch along with us. You know, go ahead and watch through at least the second disc, and then you'll be current when we do the next episode. And we'd love to get feedback from everybody on your thoughts from any of the episodes that we're talking about, and make this a larger discussion.
Absolutely, yeah. I really want people to talk about it. Because we're not just doing Babylon 5, we're going to do other stuff later, but right now we're on the first season of Babylon 5, and to get a bigger discussion about the show, especially now, because the internet really wasn't around in the 1990s. It was, but it's not like it is today. Does that make sense?
Yes. Someone said web pages back when Babylon 5 was on.
I realize, but these, there was no Twitter and Facebook. And, you know, all of the ability for us to discuss the show has changed, is what I'm saying.
Yes. Sure.
And but I want to have that discussion.
It would be interesting to talk. Hopefully we can poke Paul into doing so, and maybe getting some of our listeners and viewers. Because this is a show that was discussed online. There was an internet fandom for Babylon 5 at the time, as I'm told. And it was probably one of the first shows where that was the case, which makes it an interesting bit of fandom history intersectionality with how this show provoked fandom online.
Yeah, it would be interesting to see how anyone who maybe is listening who's actually was part of that discussion, who could actually comment on because maybe we're rehashing stuff that they were already talking about.
Sounds like we should do some recruiting for guest participants.
I think that's a good idea. So why don't we'll sideline it there. So anybody wants to leave a comment and all that kind of stuff, there's details that'll come up at the end of the show. So for now, that's disc one. Thank you, Mike, for coming on. Actually, kind of last minute. You weren't originally scheduled, and you decided to hang out.
Well, I've been a big Babylon 5 fan, so when this came up in discussion, I tried to keep my eye on it, and we'll hope to be here as frequently as possible.
Excellent. I'd love to have you. So thank you this first time.
You're certainly welcome. Thanks, guys.
And thank you, Paul, for coming in and also bringing in your knowledge.
Absolutely. One of the seminal science fiction series. How could I not participate?
Fair enough. All right. We will see everybody next week.
Good night.
Bye. Bye, all.
If you would like to send us hate mail on this episode or any other topics we've covered, you can do so in a number of ways. You can send us an email.
SkiffyandFanti@gmail.com.
You can send us a tweet.
@SkiffyandFanti.
Leave a comment on the blog.
SkiffyandFanti.com.
Go to Google Plus.
Shawnee Jen.
And or Facebook.
The Skiffy and Fanti Show. Our intro music comes from Time Flux by Revolution Void. You can check them out at freemusicarchive.org.
Just another weak human afraid to face death.
I fart in your general direction.
France, different planet.
The Force will be with you. Always.
End of line.